Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on a weekend where college and pro football games will continue the tributes to veterans a couple days after Veterans Day 2021. Whether it was the five veterans honored at the National World War II Memorial this Veterans Day and the official commemoration there, or our friend Harpo Celaya, survivor of the USS Indianapolis, receiving special recognition in his native Florence, Arizona, the candy bomber Gail Halverson, celebrated in Utah, or maybe the roar of a sold-out crowd at Fresno State's Bulldog Stadium, where I was this past week when 100-year-old Navy Wave Dorothy Jones was introduced. It's always so encouraging to me to see how much the people of our country love and respect the men and women who put their lives on the line for our freedom, and also the spirit of unity that honoring our veterans can produce. I mentioned Dorothy Jones. She's one of nine vets that you've heard on this program who are going to be traveling with the Best Defense Foundation to Hawaii for the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor next month. You're going to hear more about that as we get closer. I was actually planning to introduce you to a 100-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor in Eastern Washington this week, but after watching the way Niall Smith's story resonated with a group of young people this week and knowing that some of you may want to come meet him this coming Thursday, all those details at hometownheroesradio.com, I thought we'd focus in on his story this week. And what a story it is. He served 22 years in the Air Force, even deploying to Vietnam later in life. But back when it was still the Army Air Corps, he was handling maintenance and repairs for airplanes in the 96th Bomb Group in England. Flying was not a regular part of his job, so he would have been a very unlikely candidate for heroic actions in the midst of a violent crash.
We weren't part of the air crew, but I did go on a couple of missions, just as yeah, they were. You know how young guys are. One was a food mission when they dropped moved to the Dutch, and the other was an actual mission. But we made it back. I mean, I don't know why I did that. When I think about that now, I was stupid, you know, when I didn't have to go.
Where were you during the mission? What part of the plane did
I was back in the waist.
Uh-huh.
Back in the waist where the waist gunners are, yeah.
Did you see some exciting action?
Oh, yeah. You see them out there just like in Memphis Belle, you know, or same kind of deal. And you see things happening. I mean, planes going down, everything else. Yeah.
And in April of 1944 came an incident that I don't see how you couldn't say it changed your life. It's the reason you have the Purple Heart. It's the reason you have that Soldier's Medal I mentioned, and I'll read the citation about that in a little bit. But tell me how that all came to be, because you weren't initially supposed to be on that plane, right?
No, it was another crew, and I don't know what the other ground man or on the other crew, what reason he couldn't go for some reason, and he asked for somebody to volunteer, so I volunteered.
Don't you know you're never supposed to volunteer in the service?
Well, yeah. Yeah.
That's what everybody tells me anyway.
But
what do you think possessed you to volunteer?
Well, I knew this other guy pretty well. He's kind of a buddy, you know, and just doing it for him.
And what were you supposed to do?
Well, the two ground men went with the plane the night before. See, our squadron was all what they call pathfinders. They took the ball turret out of the bottom and put a radar dome in there, and then they led other missions because they could bomb through the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to furnish planes to other groups to lead the other groups, and two ground men always had to go with the crew in the plane to the other base, and then we'd see the plane off the next morning.
So they needed you there because you knew these specific custom planes with the radar domes, and then you would have to check them out and make sure they were flight worthy before other group would take it up?
As far as the plane, yeah.
Uh-huh, okay.
Yeah, see the plane off.
Yep.
And then we'd get a ride back to our base somehow.
So how long of a journey was this from your base to this other base?
Oh, about 30, 40 minutes.
30, 40 minutes, nighttime?
Yeah, nighttime.
No big deal.
It's close to midnight. It's right at midnight.
And did you know the Germans had night fighters?
Oh, yeah. We used to go outside, at nighttime, watch the searchlights. And I know this one night, here's a whole bunch of searchlights that had, they were on this one plane. And all at once, the lights went out. And then right behind where that plane was, here's a bunch of tracer bullets. So they set up for a British fighter to get on. Yeah, every night we'd see that. Every night.
So you knew there was a chance this could be, even though it's a short flight, that this could be dangerous.
Yeah, but we never really thought about it, mm-hmm. you know, just going to the other base. That was up at a low altitude, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But this other base was right on the coast. And this German, he must have been out there off the coast waiting for somebody to come around on the pattern, and then he followed us around.
Yeah, so tell me how you experienced it.
Okay, we was on the final approach, and under the pilot, he'd turn on the landing lights, put the flaps down, and we were slowing down, and we were maybe a couple hundred feet off the ground, and all at once I hear firing, or hear bullets, you know. And I thought the British were shooting at us from the ground with anti-aircraft fire, that maybe a little instrument they call the indicator friend or foe wasn't working. And then I looked out the side window and I saw the tracers going by. Every fifth bullet is a tracer. And I knew what it was then. I said, oh, God, you know. and I burrowed. There's a bunch of baggage back there in the waist. I was in the waist. I burrowed my way down to the bottom of that, and that's probably what saved me.
So you knew as soon as you saw those tracers that guys were going to get hit and this wasn't going to be a smooth landing.
Right. I knew we were going down, yeah.
Wow.
And the man beside me, the bombardier, he was back there asleep. I mean, missing just to another base in England, see, and he stood up, what's going on? And then a bullet hit him, see, and I got a little piece of it, but...
Where'd it get you?
In the hip. A piece of it got me in the hip. And then it was hit, because I could feel it. I could feel the blood going down my leg.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you get shot with a bullet, it doesn't hurt. It's hot.
Mm-hmm.
It's hot. That piece of metal is hot.
I want to get, and I know you're going to give us a great description of this, but I'm just thinking, everybody listening has never been in this circumstance. Maybe we have a few veterans who got shot down, but even that's a little different. I mean, you're coming in for a landing, not expecting this, and all of a sudden, this chaotic scene ensues. So, was this something that it felt like slow motion?
Yeah.
Did you have things come to mind that you didn't expect to come to mind? What was that like for you?
Well, you've heard that when you're... Well, I thought this was it, see. You're facing death. I think, well, like, tell yourself, this is it. And your whole life flashes in front of you. You've heard that. That happens.
Literally.
It happens because things came to my mind when I was a little kid that I hadn't even thought about. And then the crash, you know. But it happened.
And were there other people trying to duck for cover, screaming? Did they not have time? I mean, did you hear anything on the intercom?
No, there was nothing on the intercom. There wasn't a sound in that plane. Everybody knew what was going to happen. Of course, it was dark. I couldn't see what the people up front were doing or anything else. There wasn't time to really do anything because we hit this row of trees, and all I remember is hitting the ground and this crash or sliding or whatever, and for several minutes, I guess, and then everything stopped, you know. And so, I was still alive.
So you're conscious this whole time?
Oh, yeah. Well, I might have been knocked out for maybe an instant or so. When everything stopped, I looked around for the back door, and it wasn't there. No back door.
And before it stopped, are you bracing? You clenching your teeth? You saying a prayer? What are you doing?
Just waiting. I was just waiting for, you know, what was going to happen. Or wondering what's going to happen.
And you've believed for years that the plane just slid along the ground. And I just showed you an eyewitness account from that I found on the internet where people say the plane actually cartwheeled, went end over end. With what you remember, does it seem like maybe that could have happened?
No, I wasn't aware of that. But it might have happened.
Because you can't see anything. No, you're just feeling
it
chaos,
was dark,
right?
Right. Yeah. And the plane broke in two.
Mm-hmm.
So that could very well have happened. That was news to me.
So when the plane stops, you look for the back door. It's not there.
That's right.
What happens next?
I turned around, and it's broken in two, so I crawled out through a bunch of wreckage, the part that was open where it broke in two. And I got outside, back to the tail, and here's the other ground man, this Sergeant Matthews. He was laying there moaning and groaning. He was talking about some girl down in London, I think. And I didn't know that. I heard later that he had a broken back. I don't know if he did or not. But I saw all the flesh from his thumb, but his thumb was clear back against his wrist. Mm. So I took hold of his parachute harness, and I dragged him. He was bigger than me. I dragged him maybe 150 feet, got behind the brick wall, and then I went back to the plane. There was two or three other guys there, and
The plane's burning at this point?
Oh, yeah. It was burning more all the time. Mm-hmm. And I knew it was going to blow up. I knew that because I'd seen them blow up, you know.
Sure. So you grabbed some more guys.
Yeah, we got the pilot out. The pilot was clear back in the waist. The co-pilot, he said he went through the top. And when he came to, he had a bump on his head, and he was hanging in a tree, still strapped in his seat.
Talk about a sight you don't expect to see.
Yeah. The engineer on the plane, he was trapped down in the wreckage someplace, and he had to take his pants off to get out. He had a finger cut off. He got out. The radio man, we never did find him. We couldn't find him. Of course, the bombardier was shot, and the navigator, we found him, or he said he was in the wheel well behind number two engine, up in there somewhere. But we got everybody out, and we got them behind this brick wall. And this maybe took, 15, 20 minutes or so. And, of course, the plane's burning more all the time. And we were just waiting to see. There wasn't anything else we could do. And all at once, that thing exploded. And we had 1,700 gallons of octane fuel.
Yeah, because this, was a short flight, but yeah, a fully loaded plane, fuel-wise.
Yeah. Ooh. We had four 500-pound bombs on it, two smoke bombs for the radar part of it the next day, and about 20,000 rounds of 50-caliber ammunition on there. And, of course, when it blew up, everything went up in the air, everything, maybe 100 feet, 150 feet, and the gasoline was burning, and it arched over, and I thought it was going to fall on us. And I got up and started to run again, but it burned out before it got to the ground. Mm. So it must have been half an hour. Of course, this was off the edge of the base. See, we didn't make the runway. About a half an hour, here come an officer from the tower in a Jeep. He was in a Jeep. And the first thing he asked, he said, "Where's the parachute harnesses?" Because the gunners or the flight crew, they carried a little medical kit was strapped to their parachute harness. It had morphine and everything in it. So he started giving morphine to the people that were injured, I never even thought about that, you know. But then it must have been another hour or so before any ambulances ever got out there. And three or four ambulances come out, and they took us into, wasn't a hospital, it was just a dispensary. And they didn't do anything to us that night. I guess they looked us over and everything and washed your face and hands and stuff like that. And I'd lost my favorite cap. But anyway.
Burned up in the plane?
I don't know what happened, but it came off somewhere.
And when you said you never found the radio operator, is your guess that his body was burned in that explosion?
He was down in the wreckage someplace.
Yeah.
We couldn't find him.
But so then when the explosion happened,
he'd go up. And the next day, they took us up to a general hospital, and I was there 2 weeks and went back to base.
How much pain were you in?
I wasn't in any pain then. I was bruised and everything all over, and I still got a little piece of that bullet back there in my hip yet. I didn't know that was there until a few years ago when I had an x-ray from my back. The doctor says, "Hey, you got a piece of metal in your hip back there." I didn't know that.
It's been there a while.
Yeah. Anyway, the pilot called me, had me come up to his, where he was in the hospital there, and he thanked me for saving his life. Hmm. Because he'd come through the back from the cockpit, back through the bomb bay, through the radio room, and he was back in the waist, and we took him out. Yeah. He said that was his first night landing in a B-17.
Wow.
And get shot down.
And you said 2 weeks later you're back on the base. A lot of those guys were wounded to the point that they got sent home, but you had to keep on serving over there.
Yeah, I had to. And, well, I had to stay. And I went down to the base hospital to see the doctor because I thought, well, maybe I can get back to the States. And I started telling him how I was having these bad dreams and everything else about it, and I couldn't do my work, you know, and that kind of stuff. And he looked at me and he said, nothing wrong with you. Get back to work. So that didn't work.
Well, maybe it's a good thing because had you met a special young lady named Phyllis yet?
No, I hadn't met her yet.
Well?
But you know, after I was back to the base, they made me, after a week or so, they made me get in another plane and go up. They said, if you don't, you won't want to fly again. You don't want to get in any airplane. So I didn't. And after that, it was all right. It didn't bother me anymore.
Pretty hard to fathom all of that, isn't it? It's break time again, but there are a few more twists and turns you're not going to want to miss. Maybe even some developments still to come. If you would like to meet Niall Smith in person this week, he and a few other veterans will be with me in Clovis, California at noon on Thursday, November 18th. The event is free for veterans, $20 for the rest of us. All the information is at hometownheroesradio.com. And I do realize some of the folks who listen to Hometown Heroes aren't online all that much, so I'm going to give you a phone number to call, too, if you'd like to attend, and that's easier for you. Here's that number, 559-225-5095. That's 559-225-5095. 5095, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.